Leroy!
Welcome to my little party in your honor, Leroy. The guest list has been compiled so that you go out in style. Then let the games begin!
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of The Last Dragon.
You have been to the movies again, I see.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Kyle.
You sure look like a master to me.
Hosted by Stuart.
You weird, man. Really weird.
Justin.
I mean, I seem to be attracting the craziest people.
And Arnie.
I ain't taking you nowhere. You might embarrass me. You're too weird.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
The secret awaits eyes, unclouded by ambition. Those who are bound by desire see only that which can be held in their hands.
Listener discretion is advised.
Tonight, we make showbiz history. My way!
Today, we're discussing Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon, starring Timok, Julius J. Carey III.
Bucky! Oh my god, it's Bucky! What has you had?
Chris Murney, Leo O'Brien, Faith Prince, and Vanity, directed by Michael Schultz. Am I the meanest?
Shown up.
Am I the prettiest?
Shown up.
Am I the baddest mofo in podcasting?
Shown up.
I'm Arnie, Shogun of podcasting.
I'm Stuart.
I'm not show enough, but I am just enough.
Ah, and thank you, donors. Happy February, everyone. What are we here to talk about today, and why?
We are here to review Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon. I had to look up who Barry Gordy was. I will say that I didn't know off the top of my head, but this is at a listener request. Listener Kyle did the large pledge for a month to choose a movie for us to review, and he said he has fond memories of watching The Last Dragon over and over again on TV when he was a little kid in the early 90s. He was totally in love with it. Then 20 years later, he saw the DVD at Best Buy and was like, I haven't seen this film in 20 years, and he fell in love with it all over again. He was surprised how much it held up and wasn't one of those what was I thinking kind of movies. He felt like it was a lost gem of the 80s, so he recommends it. And he wanted to see what we thought.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll tell you the brief story is I've never seen it. Up until this request, I was aware of it. I certainly knew some of the music, DeBarge. I mean, come on, everyone knows Rhythm of the Night. I mean, I played it on piano at the time. It was a big old kit. But this movie, it had a marketing problem. I didn't know what it was supposed to be. I thought it was a musical. And you just didn't do musicals in the 80s. Music videos, yes. Musicals meant like Xanadu, The Apple, Streets of Fire. They just weren't good. So I just skipped it. I never saw Last Dragon. And I think part of it, Arnie, had to do with your parachute pants.
I think you are conflating a couple of events that happened around the same time?
No, I'm pretty sure that you decided to be the last dragon sometime in fifth grade.
There's many things that happened in fifth grade.
There's so many.
Did you have the hat, Arnie?
It is around the time, you know, you're 10 years old, you're trying to figure out who you're going to be, but it's also a weird time. I was 10 years old when this movie came out. I was in fifth grade. And I watched a lot of MTV, mostly because of my cousin who was living with me and would not turn the station off. And I saw the Rhythm of the Night video so much I could probably do the dance moves. And my memory was that actually there were fight scenes from The Last Dragon in that video. I rewatched it. There aren't. So I guess MTV just aired a lot of commercials for this or a lot of promos for this, but I was well aware of it. No plans on seeing it. Out of the blue one night, I get a call from like an acquaintance, not really a friend. It's like he used to be a friend when we were in kindergarten and we like have been friendly. And for reasons I can't fathom, he called me up one night on a Saturday as like, me and my friends are going out. You want to come? Sure. Why not? And it was like my first time out with friends at night in my life. Everything I'd done with friends was like at the mall during the day. We all go out. I'm like, my mom's asking, what movie are you seeing? I don't know. I'm just going along with the crowd. They invited me to hang out. I'm going to go hang out. I like had a great time. And we got there and they're all trying to buy tickets for the Breakfast Club. And I'm like nervous. I'm like, that's rated R, guys. We're going to get in trouble, guys. And of course, the person at the theater would not sell a bunch of fifth graders tickets to the Breakfast Club. So as plan B, we all went to see The Last Dragon.
I distinctly remember the sound more than even the image, but I believe they were maroon.
No, they were black.
You had a couple.
I only had one.
Then it was somebody else in class that had a maroon.
Yeah.
But yes, they had a distinctive sound, but that fashion of that mid-80s is just, it might be the worst of all time, really. When you think about the history of humans in clothes, that had to be it. And yeah, between the fluorescent gloves and the parachute pants and spangles and all of that, just a horrible time in fashion. There was nobody that got out of it clean. I mean, we all looked bad. But yeah, for whatever reason, you definitely took this movie and this moment to heart. You wanted to be a breakdancer in New York.
You know, I'm not sure how this movie escaped me at this age. You know, very much like you guys, I'm in fifth grade at this time. I'm a fan of The Karate Kid. I've seen Breakin'. I'm begging my mom for parachute pants. I'm moonwalking back from sharpening my pencil in class back to my desk. I mean, this movie seems like it would have been right in my wheelhouse. We have HBO. It seems like a movie that would be playing around the clock on HBO. I have never seen this movie.
Wow. I at least pride myself on knowing about it. I think I actively made the choice never to watch it in full, but wow, never heard of it. You knew the song, Rhythm of the Night, right?
Yeah, definitely. That song is, you know, everywhere, is ubiquitous at the time. But yeah, I mean, as far as this movie goes, there's a few scenes after watching it this time that kind of stuck out like it might have been like an ad for it on Cinemax or HBO that I remember faintly. But yeah, I've never sat down and watched this whole thing.
I let this movie go. I did, and I don't remember it being related to this movie, but it very well could have been. My mother did come home one day and like, I bought you new clothes, and in there were parachute pants. I did not choose them myself, but I did also didn't object. I was happy to wear them. She also, because it was coming up on summer, bought me a pair of parachute shorts.
Oh.
Now, if you're wondering how that works, it's really bad.
They zip off, right?
They do. They zip off. They had zippers that went up the outer thigh, and the zipper wouldn't stay in the down position. So basically, I was walking around in almost nothing. I was like, oh. Yeah. It was like male stripper outfit.
Oh, my.
And yes, I did try to learn how to breakdance. From a book.
Yeah, you bought a book at Walden Books. I remember coming over. We both tried to, you know, learn the moves.
Here's the thing. I didn't even understand the terminology. It's like, all right, do this, pop, and lock. I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
I couldn't even get past that. I don't know what that means. So yeah. I never became a breakdance superstar, but I forgot about this movie for 2 decades. And then I'm dating Marjorie. And like a 15th anniversary or 20th anniversary special edition DVD comes out. I'm like, you've never seen this? Oh my God. I bought it immediately at Best Buy, came home, watched it. I loved it. She didn't. In the time since, I have met both Timok and Julius J. Carey III. Both were guests at different times at New York Comic Con. I never paid for a photo or an autograph. In fact, when I saw Timok, I didn't know he was at the con. I just like walked up to him and I couldn't remember his name or his character's name. I blanked on Bruce Leroy. So I'm just like, are you him? And he goes, yes, I am.
Good answer. Yeah.
Well, it helped that he was standing at a Last Dragon booth.
Yeah.
But I'm like, so there was context.
Yes, yeah. You were not just him. Yeah, he was the Last Dragon. Indeed. Barry Gordy's Last Dragon. We should probably begin by just trying to figure out where this came from, because I think maybe the reason why people don't discover it is they didn't know how to sell it to you. I thought it was a musical because Berry Gordy founded Motown, and he had had some success in the 70s anyway, dabbling in the movies. You know, his lover was Diana Ross. He helped found the Supremes. He got her an Oscar nomination, giving her her first movie, Lady Sings the Blues, and then would have probably gotten her a Razzie if that award existed when he directed her in Mahogany. You guys ever hear of that one?
Yes, I have.
Oh, yes.
Ooh, God, it's all you need to know. All you need to know is RuPaul's favorite movie, and for good reason. That movie is just way over the top, particularly the ending. And The Wiz pretty much killed both of their movie aspirations by the end of the decade.
Was The Wiz a Berry Gordy production?
He, you know, anything Diana got involved with, he was producing on some level. But no, it was pretty much, I think after Mahogany, they were having him stay far, far away from all the creative decisions. But Gordy was bitter. He admits it. You know, 25th anniversary of Motown, all the stars come back to serenade him. It's 1983, and he's like, yeah, Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Smokey Robinson, I made all of you guys, and you left me. You left me with DeBarge. The only thing I have left is DeBarge. And that is no way to run a record studio in 1983. So why don't I get all of my musical people and rebrand Motown for the 80s? Big reason why this movie was made, so that he could sell soundtracks and sell a whole list of artists who were going to break through on the MTV generation, supposedly.
Yeah, and there was also some other stuff going on in that this script was not written at Berry Gordy's request. It was a spec script written by Louis Ventosa, and working with the director, Michael Schultz, what they wanted to do was write a story for an African-American superhero. They said that they're really, on screen, there were no African-American superheroes. In the comics, they were relegated to Black Panther or something named Black, you know, it was always a part of it. And they thought that there should be some kind of superhero up there that Black youths could look to. They wanted to make a Black movie production, but it was shot in New York. It was actual location shooting, and all the unions were all white guys. So everyone behind the scenes was white in the unions, and everybody in front of the camera was Black, but they were really trying to start an African-American driven, New York-based, music-based movie studio here.
Yeah, Michael Schultz, he has some credit to that. I mean, Cooley High is definitely one of the big films for Black filmmakers of the 70s.
Crush Groove.
I gotta say, though, if you're making a musical, you don't get the guy that made Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Are you aware that that was a movie?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that movie?
Long time ago.
When you can't get the Beatles, the Bee Gees aren't the answer. That's all I'm going to say. It was a horrible film. One of the worst I've ever seen. Enjoyably so. Brown Arrow all the way. But I'm really surprised they let this guy direct another movie musical.
But, you know, in today's cynical world of everything having synergy and having hype and, you know, you do this and this comes out to support it or whatnot, the time this movie is being made and what Berry Gordy's doing, it doesn't seem out of place or out of character, you know? I mean, to listen to that story of how he was trying to resurrect Motown after his stars leaving him for bigger and better things, I can't fault the guy. You know, if I would hear that story today, I'd be like, well, whatever, your time has passed, it's time to move on. But this seems like somewhat of a lofty yet, you know, noble goal.
Yeah, I agree. And Blaxploitation. I mean, you're right. There had been a big movement in the 70s to put Blacks behind the camera and in front. And by the early 80s, that kind of went away. I don't even know who the Black stars were at that time. It just, if you aren't Eddie Murphy, there's nobody Black on screen with you. And so that needed to change. And I guess Last Dragon is the movie to make that attempt.
This movie was a success. It was budgeted at $10 million, and I did listen to the director's commentary by Michael Schultz. He's not a very talkative man, so I listened to Long Periods of Dead Air by Michael Schultz. But one of the things he did say when he deigned to speak was that you don't make $25 million if you're only appealing to Black audiences. This had crossover appeal. This played well in Middle America and turned a very decent profit.
Wow. I would love to see the faces of the people watching it at the time. I know how mine looked today, and I thought I knew what I was in for.
Mine was elation. My eyes were wide. My smile was big. I mean, it's a Star Wars kung fu film. That's what I said then. I'm like, you took Star Wars, and instead of the Force, you got the glow.
The glow.
Yeah, you definitely have a glow, Arnie. That means you get to do the plot. We'll get into The Last Dragon.
Who's the mean bastard who terrorizes all the people in Harlem? Shonuff, played by Julius J. Carey III. Because when you're tough, you know you're the third.
Not to be confused with J.B. Smoove.
Sho and his gang run rampant, stealing, destroying, and generally being jerks. But because Shonuff is a martial artist and the self-proclaimed Shogun of Harlem, no one can stand up to him. The only one who could is Leroy Green, played by Timok, a kung fu fighter who's known in Harlem as Bruce Leroy. But Leroy follows his code not to fight. More, he has a crisis of self-confidence. He has not yet reached the final level of kung fu, the level that gives him a power called the glow. But despite Leroy still trying to attain this, his master says there's nothing more he can teach Leroy. Meanwhile, in Harlem, video arcade owner Eddie Arcadian, played by Chris Murray, is working to make a star of his girlfriend Angela, played by Faith Prince. He wants Angela's music video played on the hot TV show hosted by Laura Charles, played by Vanity, but Laura refuses. Eddie sends his goons to kill her, but Leroy is nearby and saves the music video queen. Laura also starts to fall for Leroy when she hires him as her bodyguard. Leroy's enemies combine forces when Eddie hires Shonuff to take care of Leroy so he can force Laura to play the video. And it leads to a showdown in Harlem between the two kung fu masters. In the fight, Leroy learns he had the power all along inside of him. He starts to glow and kicks Shonuff's ass and ties up Eddie for the cops. And Laura and Leroy finally lock lips at the TV studio as credits roll.
Shonuff.
Now you say Leroy has reached the pinnacle, but at the beginning here, he's doing his whole karate moves with a yellow belt on. I don't know much about karate, but that's pretty low on the totem pole. I assume he's better than a yellow belt, right?
I think he was more about fashion and accessorizing than he was about climbing the kung fu ladder of mastery.
Listen, this guy is good. We have Timok here. This man has never acted before this movie, but they knew they wanted somebody who could do the moves. They almost got Billy Blanks. It was so close to Billy Blanks.
Wow. That would have been a very different movie. Tybo? He's got a different energy. I feel like I'm scared of Tybo. But yeah, this guy seems very sweet, very fun, very approachable, very much like a leading man you want in a romantic comedy, which this kind of is. I mean, it's many things at once. But Timok had not acted before. I'm going to give my hat off to him. I think that for a natural performer, he's no Oscar winner, but he does carry this movie.
He had the innocent smile and the sweetness when he auditioned that they thought would serve the character well, and they hired two acting coaches to be on set the entire time. What the director said is one would get exhausted trying to teach Timok to act, and the other would then come in. Like tag team.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, like a boxing match. How appropriate.
But they did, in virtually every major city in the country, a search for an African-American young male martial artist who could do the moves of this. And in the scene at the beginning, I thought this was the case, and I had to look it up, and it was, where we see him in slow-mo hit an arrow out of the air and break it in half, there's no effects fakery there. That actually happened. Now, it happened after take after take after take, but it still happened, and I don't care. You could give me 100 hours, and I'd never get that. I'd be impaled, but I'd never break the arrow in the air.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I mean, it's no catching a fly with chopsticks out of midair, but it's up there.
He's going to catch a bullet with his teeth, mofo. Take that, fly.
Yeah, and this stuff feels grafted on. I don't know that he needed to have a karate master, but Karate Kid had just come out the year before, right? So everyone figured you needed a Mr. Miyagi, even though he's not going to be much of this movie. We have Master here setting him off on the path, telling him basically you can go off, you have reached the highest level, and that's just not good enough. This Leroy is insecure, and he wants one more master.
Well, that's because he doesn't have the glow. He knows there's a glow. So since he hasn't gotten it, he doesn't think he's at that high level.
Yeah, I thought that was a metaphorical glow. I'll find out how wrong I am at the end of this movie. But I'm like, yeah, you know, a glow about you. Self-confidence. I know what that is. I didn't know there was radiation lines, but yeah.
We're going to get a literal glow, but yeah, I mean, to Arnie's point, the master does seem a little tacked on at the beginning, but now thinking about the way Arnie talks about it, if this is Star Wars or your classic hero's journey, if you will, this is the Yoda character. This is the wise master who will set you on the path of adventure into becoming who you can fully become.
And they were really looking at Bruce Lee films. They had the rights to Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon.
So were we. We watched half of one during the airing of this movie.
Yeah, they had the rights for that footage to Enter the Dragon before production started. They really were looking at old kung fu flicks and a way to make a loving parody of them. And the kung fu master is just a trope from those films that, yeah, Lucas ripped off with Obi-Wan and Yoda. And here we see it coming full circle.
I gotta know, Justin, first time going through, I think I remembered it. I saw this movie in pieces throughout the 80s and 90s on TBS occasionally. Some dumb guy. Did you figure it out before he got to the cookie factory?
Yeah, it seemed pretty much like a wild goose chase from the beginning, for sure.
Yeah, I think you would know. I think any adult watching this would be like, wait, what did he say? Some dumb guy? Oh, okay. He's telling him that you have to be, you're a dumb guy if you think you need anything more.
Yeah, there's that dirty joke, cream of some young guy. And so there's that, yeah, here.
Right. There's many plot strands in this, and they don't always come together so cleanly. But yes, the major arc for Leroy, at least in his development, is that he wants to get the glow, and he believes, like Dorothy going off to see the wizard, that it's going to come from some external magical force and not with him the whole time.
Right. I think he thinks that there's more he needs to learn. He just doesn't know enough. I don't think he's looking for a talisman so much as what he's given is some medallion to take to some dumb guy. And in exchange for the talisman, he will teach Leroy the final lesson. When in fact, this is all just a wild goose chase, because I noticed at this time, because I know the movie now, the master here says, you have with you all that you need. It's like, yeah, it's in him. This movie, and we're going to see it at the end in montage, screaming out to us all the times this movie drops the clues that Leroy has the mastery if he had the self-confidence.
Sure, it's a good story. It's a good lesson. Again, it played in Wizard of Oz. It plays here as well. Also playing The Temptations, because nothing says like the 80s like that 60s boy band.
Doo-wop was so in. I am listening to the 80s on 8 Big 40 countdown every week religiously, and it surprises me how many 50s and 60s song covers were top charting in the 80s. I think what happened is the baby boomers grew up and they had nostalgia for the music of their youth, and so it was covered. And I mean, Billy Joel's An Innocent Man album is an entire tribute to that.
Oh yeah, the 80s are a complete rewrite of the 50s, and yeah, the Big Chill soundtrack would have made all of those old songs. I mean, it's how I became familiar with them again, but again, you're not relaunching the Temptations at this point. It's crazy to think Berry Gordy thinks he's going to get another number one single out of these guys, but it's also crazy that Leroy is going to go to town literally dressed as a Chinese peasant, complete with rice paddy hat. I mean, that's nuts.
I love that. I love eating popcorn with chopsticks. And I got to admit this. When I saw this in theaters at the young age of 10, I didn't know it was parody. I didn't know that this was all supposed to be funny. I mean, the same way I thought Batman 66 was just a superhero show when I was a kid, I took this all at face value. I'm like, yep, chopsticks with popcorn. Now I found out from the commentary, this scene was filmed in one of New York's prevalent adult theaters during the daytime when it was closed. He probably had the chopsticks because he didn't want to touch anything in there.
And I think you hit on something there, Arnie. I think ultimately why a movie like this can withstand the test of time and at least live in some nostalgic little happy bubble is because a lot of times we see it for the first time as a kid and we take it at face value. And then when we revisit it later, we realize it is parody and there's more to it for us to chew on this time as an adult. So I think there's a lot of that going on already in this movie here.
Yeah, and it's a delight to see it now as an adult, because I think whenever I did discover this movie, I was in that awkward age where I assumed that because something was silly, it meant that it was bad. And so I just assumed, oh, this is stupid. Why would I watch this movie? And I don't think I gave it its due, but it's very clearly now lovingly evoking blaxploitation of the 70s and musical tropes and kung fu tropes and all in a mishmash that, yeah, is one of a kind.
It's also walking a line of parody that it doesn't go so far over. I mean, years later, there would be a movie called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka.
I love that movie.
It's a great movie, but it's a full-on parody, balls to the wall. We're taking fun of every trope out of blaxploitation. This is still kind of somewhat of a love letter to the genre.
And because it's the 80s, there are things now, 30 years later, that I don't know if it's a parody or if it's just of the time. Like when Sho Nuff walks in the theater, he's got those silly sunglasses that were like Venetian blinds, you know?
Yeah. In the 80s, it's hard to be sure how much of that was them thinking they were cool. I mean, too much cocaine, or did they know that they were outrageous and it was all part of the campy act?
Sure, yeah. Sho Nuff's entire entourage of goons, are they dressed that way because they think it's cool? Because maybe it was back then. I mean, Arnie, you had parachute pants. Would you wear a mesh shirt with a camouflage vest over it?
I dare ya.
You already peeked at my Comic-Con outfit, Justin. But yeah, I love Sho Nuff when he puts on the football pads, wears some like an outfit, but it's obviously red shoulder pads. I mean, the whole thing, I just don't know. It's crazy. It's nuts.
It springs from our love of the pimp, right? I mean, 70s blaxploitation really glamorized the pimp and their outrageous attire, the shoes, the capes, all of that. If you're going to be a pimp, you had to stand out. I mean, the word itself has become an adjective for being flashy. And I just think that, yeah, you got to have a character. If you're making blaxploitation in any era, you got to have someone that goes way too far in their couture. And yeah, this guy's, he's great. And he's great as the villain, too.
And this actor, apparently, he is in real life a very subdued man who they said if you met him on the street, you'd think he was a banker. It turns out I've seen him in a bunch of movies that I never placed him as Sho Nuff in. And he did not know martial arts. He, just like Timok had to learn acting, Julius had to learn some martial arts. And then they had a real hard time finding a stuntman that was as tall as this guy at 6'2" to do the stunts. But yeah, I always thought Sho Nuff was also a martial artist. And I also thought that was his real hair.
Julius Carey, but just want to point out, he's in one of my personal guilty pleasures favorites. We covered him when we covered Disco Godfather. He was Bucky, who had a really bad acid trip and required Rudy Ray Moore to save him.
He was also the coach in the DJ Qualls film, The New Guy.
Yeah, didn't get to that one.
I've seen that more times than I can count.
But if this movie wanted to be neat and organized, they could just make this West Side Story, right? Your gang versus my gang. And it seems like the people are on Leroy's side. This fight happens in the theater. Leroy doesn't, you know, he hits the exit. He doesn't lift a fist, but everyone else is ready to fight Sho Nuff. They just can't match him. And so I think, okay, this is going to be a gang movie musical, kind of like West Side Story.
I'm so glad that it's not a musical. I'm just going to put it out there that if it had been, I don't think I would have enjoyed it when I was so young. And yeah, we get to see Sho Nuff kick somebody's ass. The guy comes up and kicks Sho Nuff from behind and does the moves. You can tell that this may have been the number two fighter who Timok beat out for the role. And you think, okay, Sho Nuff has a fight on his hands, but Sho Nuff is going to just break his ankle in three pieces while Bruce Leroy, I just love that name, Bruce Leroy, goes out the door.
Just walks away. Yeah, I mean, we recently just talked about a movie, Double Dragon, where our heroes were constantly running away from hordes of gangs and not necessarily turning and fighting. But in this movie, this is what it's building to. At least we know why he isn't fighting. He's more of a pacifist and he's on his own journey. So the fact that we're not seeing him engage in fisticuffs the entire film makes sense to me already up to this point, where with you know, Double Dragon, it never clicked with me why these major fighters were not fighting.
And I'm going to argue, this movie is a musical. It just takes the stance that all the successful musicals of the 80s took. If there's going to be songs, it's going to be because someone's playing a music video or performing on a stage. We're not going to just have characters randomly break into a signature tune. We're going to have it be within the context of the story that they're playing music. But music's very important here, and that's why we spend so much time at Seventh Heaven and dealing with Eddie Arcadian trying to break into the music biz.
Seventh Heaven, the dance club that's also like Solid Gold, where the kids come in and dance, hosted by Vanity. Ooh, did I have a thing for Vanity in the 80s, too. First of all, I didn't discover her for the music. I didn't discover her through Prince. I saw her in this movie, but didn't pay attention. But man, was she hot in her guest starring role in Friday the 13th, the series.
What? This is what you know her from? I went in this being like, oh, she's the girl from Purple Rain. The fact that there's an Apollonia and a Vanity ended up blowing my mind. I didn't realize there was two different actresses here. I just assumed this was her encore for Purple Rain.
And neither of them are Sheila E.
Yeah. No, Sheila E. is the drummer. I know her, but Vanity is, yeah, she's a Prince girl, but she wasn't in Purple Rain. And she's hysterical. Her entrance where she descends from the ceiling and pantomimes the Seventh Heaven theme song is like, man, Marilyn McCoo having a seizure. It's hilarious.
Oh.
Is this playing as funny? Because this is the first time I'm seeing some cracks in this movie where I'm like, uh-oh, this could go off the rails for me because she is really hamming it up here.
Oh, and her moves reminded me of like the Backstreet Boys when they were doing the Universal Monsters. I mean, it really was like Fright Night 2 level of craziness with those arms. But I think that's just the 80s. I think that's just, yeah. I don't think that's parody. I think that was in. I think that was like the type of dance moves I wanted to learn.
Yeah, but Downtown Julie Brown didn't come into Club MTV like doing her own number. Like she just held the microphone and introduced the tune here. But it's like Vanity wants to steal the spotlight away. She wants to be a singer, but she has to be content being a VJ, which was a new occupation at this time. MTV is only, what, half a decade into its existence. And so the idea that the most glamorous job you could have on television is to introduce music videos is something that would play very well to Arnie and myself, any kid of our generation at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And the music, I'll just say I love this soundtrack. When I bought this movie in the early aughts, I immediately went out and got the soundtrack again. And I mean, I'm not just talking Rhythm of the Night. I'm talking about Vanity's Seventh Heaven song. I'm talking about The Last Dragon by Dwight David. I mean, I like all of this stuff. Peeping Tom by Rockwell. It's just a great soundtrack. Motown put out a really good album here, and it was a high seller, too. So I'm not minding her dance moves because it's coming with retro fun music.
Yeah, I don't think it saved Berry Gordy, but I mean, he was hoping to relaunch a whole series of artists. But yeah, the soundtrack certainly works for the movie and the world we're within.
I'm mostly enjoying the soundtrack, and I don't want to beat on it too much, but the Vanity song was also pretty down there for me as well. The moves, the song, the whole thing was couldn't have been oversuit enough for me.
And I want to say I did become a bit more of a Vanity music fan in later years. I just like 5 years ago went on a tear. I had to have that Vanity 6 album, and I had to have it yesterday. And I got that and almost played it till it broke in my car.
Very nice.
Okay.
But what we have set up here is a vehicle to maybe explore or exploit some new artists. And one of the artists, the main artist that the movie itself is trying to get out there.
I don't have Michael Jackson anymore, but I got Elle.
Oh, boy.
Elle DeBarge. You know, you can't. She's right. I mean, she calls it the hot pick of the week. There's no doubt about it. I mean, that's why they give full consideration. They play the whole music video.
The entire thing. The only thing that was missing were the credits in the corner.
We'd be disappointed if they didn't. As music video fans, you want to see that music video. It's the actual music video that also ran on MTV. Stark contrast. You look at the Latins in the music video, you're like, wow, those people can dance. You look at the white people in the club dancing around the music video. Oh boy, cut away.
Well, that was solid gold every week. But
it was.
This was not El DeBarge. This was actually the full DeBarge out of this. This song did go platinum. And out of this, Berry Gordy offered L and Bunny DeBarge separate solo contracts. So this song actually broke up the DeBarges.
Oh, wow. They were too big. He had to, you know, go off on his own and romance Johnny Five.
Then that DeBarge shipwrecked real quick.
Yeah. But Vanity knows hits and she knows flops. And that's why she's not willing to play the music of Angela Vicario.
You mean Cyndi Lauper?
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty obvious that what they're going for, which doesn't make any sense. Cyndi Lauper was all over MTV. It would be a big hit. But I think the idea is they wanted to create maybe Berry Gordy's idea of what was wrong with music in the 80s were people like Cyndi Lauper who were just kind of annoying and outrageous and kind of getting by on glitz and maybe not for actual vocal chops.
And I thought every time I saw this movie, including the first one, the reason she wouldn't work wasn't because the music was bad, wasn't because she was a Cyndi Lauper ripoff. I thought she was too old because I swear every time I see this movie, I think she's like 45. I feel so bad because I looked her up this time. She's 28. I don't know what they did to her to make her look 45, but she really looks like she'd be entering this end stages of her working career. And no, she's in her 20s.
Yeah, that's a hard 28 coming out. I mean, she does look middle-aged here. But to Stuart's point, I paid attention because I was wondering how they were going to go with this, because her music video was ridiculous, but the music itself, the song itself, was no more ridiculous than what Vanity had just shown us of her own talent. And I was waiting for it. I'm like, okay, is Vanity going to sit here and act like she's superior to Angela? And what she actually said was, it's good, I'm just not going to do it this way. So it wasn't about her music being bad or her video not being sellable. It was the way Arcadian went about getting her there that made her turn off from this entire process.
I think it's both. I mean, I do think that the song, it isn't on the soundtrack. Dirty Books, I don't believe, is actually on the CD, should you buy it. You know, Dirty Books, it's obviously a reference to Cyndi Lauper's She Bop, which was about dirty magazines. Again, I know what they're going after there. And I have to believe it's Berry Gordy being critical about certain pop stars maybe being undeserving when we should really be listening to The Temptations, damn it.
And the director talked about how there was a challenge here because Berry Gordy said, we want silly music. We want outrageously bad music. But it has to sound good and it has to be like it could be a hit. So they like had to go with silly outfits and silly lyrics, but actually good music because Barry was putting them in that double bind. But no, sadly, neither of these is on the soundtrack. And I would actually really like to listen to Dirty Books.
Okay. I don't know. I certainly don't need to relive it in audio form, but it works in the sense of she's a music video artist and she wants to get played on this top 40 music video club. And Eddie, I think because they grew up together, my impression is they've been boyfriend, girlfriend for a long time. He's sold on turning her into a pop star and is willing to do anything for it, including rough up Vanity.
Yeah. And you say that they grew up together. And like I said, she's only 28 and he's 42. So if I thought they grew up together, yeah, then her age would be closer to what I thought it was. It's going to be revealed, though, he kind of goes through stars. His biggest goon is Rock, played by Mike Starr, who I will forever know as the Gas Man from Dumb and Dumber.
Exactly. That's exactly where I recognized him from.
He's been in a ton of stuff. I mean, but every time I see him, I'm like, hey, it's the Gas Man. But Uncle Buck and the Money Pit, who's that girl? But he was going to be a boxer, hence Rock, Rocky. And he ended up not being very good. So Arcadian turned him into his goon and now is bringing up Angela to be the next one, and she's going to call him out on it at the end. It's all for him. Eddie just wants the high life. It looks like he has it. His name is Arcadian. He runs a successful chain of arcades. I don't know why he needs the boxing / music video stardom as well. He wants to be either the next Don King or the next Berry Gordy. He doesn't really care which.
I'm not even sure he knows. I mean, yes, that is his motivation at the beginning here, is to get Angela played on Seventh Heaven, because that's the show. But by the end of this movie, he's broken up with Angela, and he's no longer even concerned with that. He's more into kidnapping and making sure that Leroy is taken care of.
These guys are like the villain's light. Like, Shownuff is clearly like the big bad, but these guys come off a lot like, if you think about that Richard Donner Superman. Arcadian is Gene Hackman, Angela is Miss Tessmacher, and the big guy is Ned Beatty's Otis.
What's really funny is even before you said Superman, I'd already equated them to Superman 3 with the businessman and the sister and the girlfriend.
I don't think they were wanting to reference Superman 3, but again, they have that interaction of being goofy villains, funny villains. Yeah, they are a conflict that must be overcome. They constantly put vanity in danger, but they're never going to do anything too bad. If you're worried about physical violence, it's going to come from Shownuff. And it takes a long time for them to hook up with Shownuff.
Yeah, it really does. We're going to get another Shownuff scene. We're going to find out that despite having his own master, Bruce Leroy pays the bills, not by working at his dad's pizza place, but by running his own dojo and training a bunch of people in the way of martial arts. And Shownuff is going to come in and take over. And by taking one of Leroy's students hostage, make him kiss his Converse.
Kneel before the king is the idea here. Shownuff is all about dominance of the neighborhood. You know, that's his main motivation. And to get Leroy, the one guy who could threaten his power, to kneel before him in front of his class is the ultimate embarrassment for somebody like Leroy.
And if you learn one thing from Karate Kid, it's that the people that use karate for dominance and aggression are wrong. That is absolutely not what you use martial arts for. And it comes from internal peace. That's always the thing. You know, again, they're teaching kids pacifism and patience and self-confidence and not feeling like you need to bully people into getting your way just because you might be stronger. Good lessons for a kid movie for sure. And again, it makes us like Leroy. I don't think we judge him. We feel bad for him that he has to kiss the Converse, that he's humiliated in front of his students. But we know he has the power to beat this guy. We never think that he doesn't. He's just trying to follow a path in which he can become, you know, his greatest self.
Yeah, and he even has that mantra where he's teaching the students, I will not use my art. I will not fight unless attacked, that sort of thing. It's, you know, same as a Jedi. Uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never for attack. I think that actually is the teaching of most martial arts, though. The reason you learn to fight is so you don't have to fight. I truthfully believe that's part of the culture, not just the we don't want kids to go out and punch each other.
It's truly the philosophy of Bruce Lee. I mean, I do think he remains, for me, I've only seen Enter the Dragon, and I rewatched it before I saw this movie because I wanted to have it fresh in my mind. But he remains my favorite action star just because he did have such conviction to his poetry. I mean, he can say a whole bunch of fortune cookie bullshit, but you believe it because that guy can just sell you that what he's doing, yeah, transcends mere action movie tropes. And so he's the perfect foil for Leroy Green. I mean, he's even wearing that orange Bruce Lee Game of Death jumpsuit, the one that Uma Thurman would co-opt and kill Bill in that scene. I mean, Bruce Lee hangs all over these scenes, and I think he's a good role model. But I do feel like this movie in the middle, Act 2, really struggles to do anything new. That they hit the same beats again and again and again. And one of these beats is that Shownuff is going to come somewhere and say, I want to fight, I want to fight, I want to fight. One that's going to be denied him all the way until the very end of the movie.
The movie is simply too long. I felt that this time going in. And we're introduced to Leroy's family, which is a subplot that I kind of like his relationship with his brother, Richie, because the little brother is so much cooler than his nerdy older brother, despite the fact, when talking fifth grade, Justin, were ninjas like the ultimate badass for you, like magical, spiritual?
Oh, yeah. Everybody wanted to be a ninja.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like the closest thing you could come to actually having the Force. I remember one guy on the school bus said he was going to bring a throwing star and throw it at Stuart. And we were like petrified because a throwing star, that's instant death. Mm. You got a throwing star? You got the weapon of a ninja?
Yeah. He got it from the back of a Boys Life magazine. Nailed away for it. But yeah, I remember feeling like my life was in peril because, yeah, ninjas were scary and new to American culture at this time. I don't think I had any exposure to ninja movies before around this period, American Ninja.
I still think that's why Snake Eyes is the most popular G.I. Joe, is because in the 80s, he co-opted the ninja motifs. And so here, despite the fact that you would think Bruce Leroy as a ninja is going to be the coolest mofo around, his little brother is actually much cooler, much hipper, and Bruce Leroy is a nerd. And as for the little sister, I don't know why we have Rudy from The Cosby Show, Keisha Knight Pulliam, here for one, two scenes, but we do.
You're trying to hit all audiences. For people our age, we like to see young kids in a movie. So yeah, is Richie needed here? I would say if you're going to trim things, this movie would probably be narratively stronger if we lost the younger brother and we could just kind of get to more fighting and more musical sequences more often. But I think young audiences like to see young stars. And I had an older brother. I like to take him down a peg. I related to Richie.
Yeah, part of the appeal of this movie is the urban backdrop. You know, I mean, it's not just a Bruce Lee movie that's taking place in Japan. I mean, this is taking place in Harlem. So we need somebody, if our main character isn't going to be street smart, we need somebody to be that voice for us. And I think Richie does a fine job of being that character for us. He's not necessarily overused as a character, and there's a little bit of a love conflict between him and Vanity and Leroy that was unnecessary. But for the most part, I think his inclusion helps this movie along more so than, like you said, Stuart, the continuous escalation of Shonuff wanting to fight and Vanity being kidnapped and escaping.
Yeah, she's kidnapped a lot. That's another beat that's hit way too often. And the love story, which is very sweet. I was surprised how well it actually works. Watching it this time, it was something I don't think I ever cared about whenever I half watched it in the past. But yeah, she's a lot of fun. She's very beautiful, and I can see why he would be enamored with her, and vice versa, why she would be wanting him for her bodyguard. But there's just too many scenes of her throwing herself at him and him wandering away to fulfill his quest.
I kind of like that, because if he had a thing for her and she was turning him away, or she seemed cold to him, first of all, that seems like the more common trope. That's the Sam and Diane, where Sam's constantly going after cold fish Diane. I like that they've reversed that and made her the aggressor, and that he is interested in her, but again, he doesn't know art. He doesn't even have a pen. So he's not sure what to do, and he's called away because his true love is martial arts, and he wants to find that glow, and he finds a fortune cookie shop of some dumb guy.
What you're saying here, Arnie, is the journey his master has sent him on. He's been such a good student at learning martial arts all these years that he's forgotten to be a kid and have child experiences and grow up into adolescence and fall in love. These are all things that he missed out on for being such a dedicated student. And these are the things that he needs to find and learn to become the master that he's searching out to be.
Right. But instead of that, he's convinced that his future lies with a master in a fortune cookie shop.
And I love the guys who own this fortune cookie shop who are outside. It's just really funny to me to see three Asians who want to be black talking to a black man who wants to be Asian. And then one of the Asians starts doing the pidgin English thing to talk to the black guy.
There's something overtly offensive here, and I'm not sure I can put my finger on it.
Yeah, I'd be surprised, you know, as I usually am when I look at movies in the 70s and 80s, a time when the term political correctness just did not exist, that some of the jokes are just, wow, they really went there. I remember some of the goons coming back and saying, hey, you know, instead of one guy beating up, it was a bunch of black guys with pipes. I was like, I don't think you could make that joke these days. But again, that's part of the fun. What can sometimes shock us about a past that we sometimes romanticize and think is too innocent. Yeah, but racial politics aside, this is all very fun. And I think affirming for young audiences. I think that all ethnicities will find an identifiable character here.
And every ethnicity is also going to be made fun of here. I think it's an equal opportunity offender, you know? God, could this be the 80s version of Blazing Saddles?
Perhaps. I mean, you got his student, Johnny Yu, who thinks just being Asian is enough to scare people. I just have to go, whoa, 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 and that's all. I don't need to fight. It's the art of fight without knowing how to. And that's kind of fun as well.
So, yes, Leroy shows up at some dumb goy to find these characters who end up being the gatekeeper for the master he's searching out, and they absolutely will not let him in. So we feel like he's come to the conclusion of his journey, but only to be turned away.
And it's because he doesn't get into the fortune cookie shop. He happens to be at the right place at the right time when Laura gets kidnapped again. I don't quite know how many times she's going to get kidnapped in this movie.
It's her job. Other than selling music videos, it's just to constantly be grabbed by goons. But it's the first one, actually. She's getting in her limo, and it's a different driver. And, you know, because she won't have dinner with Arcadian, they're going to, I don't know, rough her up, feed her to the sea monster? I'm not sure.
Different driver, played by Chaz Palminteri?
Yeah, in an unrecognizable mustache.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of unrecognizable and somewhat recognizable, did you guys catch William H. Macy?
Yes. Briefly, you see him as well, far, far away from his theater work with David Mamet, which is what he would have been more known for at this point in time in his career.
Yeah, that was a very funny thing where he's like the producer afraid of Arcadian trying to tell Laura to put the music video on. And I know it's not good to, you know, don't let the terrorists win, but for crying out loud, just play the damn video.
Some people like Cyndi Lauper, for Christ's sake.
if it's a bomb, then it's really hurting Angela more than anything, and that they're probably all going to make fun of her. Just put it on. Let her make a fool of itself. It's not like Seventh Heaven is going to suddenly tank in the ratings because they show one crap video.
Well, keep in mind, this is Barry Gordy's ego that we're watching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, she gets kidnapped and we get to see Bruce Leroy come in and save her and kick the ass of all the goons. Now we have Bruce Leroy fighting Eddie, Bruce Leroy not fighting Shonuff, Bruce Leroy trying to get into the fortune cookie plot. There are a lot of just things going on, and the movie can't find the rhythm of the night in this middle part.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to praise this movie, and I think there are a lot of elements to celebrate here, it's never going to be the script. I mean, this script is never more than getting you from one point to the other in the sloppiest way imaginable. Redundant as well. I mean, again, people keep dropping things. The medallion gets dropped. Someone conveniently drops like a notepad or something that tells them where Vanity was taken to at one point. I mean, it just, yeah, it's really bad plotting, but plotting's not the point.
I'll agree with you that the plotting is bad, but I can't argue with the script that has the jokes it has in here. I think that the wordplay is good. The pacing is bad.
There's enough here to keep you interested, but the main thing that happens here in this middle part is to bring our two villains together. We get our man and our main protagonist together, finally, to team up against their common enemy.
Yeah, because just like in Double Dragon, which we reviewed on Tuesday, Eddie Arcadian is going to hire every gang member in the city to go after Laura. And yeah, part of that includes Mr. Nuff.
This is kind of a fun scene where he's interviewing. It's like a job interview. There's a guy that's like a dog that can headbutt a table and break it in half. There's another guy who just holds up a newspaper clipping of how a co-ed was thrown in an incinerator. That was kind of spicy, wasn't it? I was like, damn, that joke's, again, a political correctness. I don't know if you could quite pull that off in a kid-oriented film these days, but maybe.
Yeah, and juxtapose against the backdrop of these bad guys being interviewed in the arcade. That's good visual poetry for a movie like this.
I feel like they needed to get to this faster. I feel like everything that happened in the middle, you're right, it's about 20, 15 minutes that could probably just be thrown out, but then you'd be losing music. And again, I think that was a directive Barry Gordy insisted on.
But the one thing you really could take out and affect nothing is Shonuff going to the father's pizza joint and wrecking it. Because that doesn't spur Leroy into any action. It does, I guess, cause some tension between him and his brother. But Shonuff finds him because of Eddie kidnapping Laura again. So the fact that Shonuff went in and smashed up the pizza place and terrorized, yeah, there's a little bit of comedy in that the father knows enough to be scared, but the mother's going to throw pizza dough at them like a Three Stooges movie. But beyond that, it's like, I thought that was going to be the inciting incident that brought us to the climax, and it turns out to be pointless.
Pointless, I don't know. I mean, could it have been done differently or could it have been condensed with another scene? What it does is it sets up and actually shows us that Shonuff is in charge of the neighborhood. There's nobody around to do anything about it. And he actually is a badass and somebody to be feared. Up until now, I'm not sure if we know that. Like, he keeps just showing up wherever Leroy is and picking on Leroy.
Honestly, I don't think we'd have this Eddie Arcadian plot if Berry Gordy weren't producing The Last Dragon. Because he's a music producer, he wants to bring in a would-be music producer as a villain. But that storyline has very little to do with a neighborhood terrorized by a big bully. Which is where I think, again, it's the part that we're all waiting for. When will Leroy finally show down Shonuff and win over the girl in the neighborhood? That's all this movie had to be, but I think because it's a musical, you had to have those musical sequences, and you needed to have the Lex Luthor soft villain to kind of come in here and be wormy.
But if you look at blaxploitation films, having the rich white devil as a bad guy also is a trope of them.
Sure.
So the fact that he wants music videos played is, of course, Berry Gordy directive. But to have Shonuff be the muscle and have someone like Eddie Arcadian be the brains and the money, I think that that's just something that would have been here no matter.
Yeah, and, you know, who wouldn't want to see the glow? I got to say, a highlight. Before Leroy actually gets the glow, he learns that it's a rap song. Laura takes him. I think, did she make it special? She like took old Bruce Lee movies, spliced them together to this very old school rap song, and hopes that that will be the thing to finally get a kiss out of him.
Seriously, that rap song is a skip away from Rapper's Delight. I mean, it is seriously
very, very close. But instead of almost getting that kiss, what it does is it awakens an idea in Leroy.
Yeah, he sees Bruce in disguise, so I can do that too.
Yes, he's going to deliver a bean sprout pizza to the master and teach the guys how to play craps while they wait for the master. He's going to teach them hopscotch.
I'm not sure what you're getting out of this, but it's silly in a way that I think is agreeable. I mean, I'm not laughing, but I'm not angry either.
I wonder if this is the period where you're supposed to be getting stoned in the New York theaters, because those Asian guys at the Fortune Cookie Factory are saying, come in, smoke some herb, chill out. Maybe you're just enjoying being in the theater, making out with your girlfriend and getting high.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad plan watching a movie like this. That we're sitting here and parsing out meanings of plots and whether it's satisfying is beyond the point. This movie is its sum total of its the smiles it produces, the songs that stick in your head, and the fights that make an impact. It's an experience. It's not a story.
Right. And, you know, as far as it not being a story goes, this is where we find out that the master that he's been chasing this whole time has been just a wild goose chase. And it's just a computer that writes the fortune cookies.
And I love that the medallion is a belt buckle, because earlier when he lost it and Laura has it, she's like, oh, you mean that belt buckle looking thing? It was a belt buckle all along.
Sure. And while he's doing this, this is another opportunity for her to get kidnapped along with Richie and lead us finally to what I think is the climax. And we're finally going to see that everything in a nice evocation of Enter the Dragon's climax. You know, that movie builds to this hall of mirrors where Bruce sees himself and, you know, he's trying to find the bad guy who has like some fur-lined claws or something. It's really ridiculous. But they tried to do this here in Seventh Heaven with all the video screens and then all of the bad guys that have been hired.
Yeah, they were really proud of this video screen stuff. They went on and on in the bonus features about how nobody had ever done something like that in a movie before, using VHS technology to project live on a screen while filming behind it and things like that. I'm like, really? Oh, okay, great. But it does have a cool effect.
Did they never make a video game of this? I mean, after watching Double Dragon and I'm not seeing the video game in that movie, I feel like this should have been like an arcade game. I mean, I would have had so much fun jumping around a nightclub fighting these fools.
This movie made $25 million in a time when the the only games that were based on movies were like Star Wars, the number one film of all time. And don't forget, E.T. killed the Atari. Nobody was rushing to make an Atari 2600 game where you start glowing with yellow blocks instead of black blocks when you have the glow.
Oh, of course not. But I mean, they did it for Warriors. Decades later, that became a video game. I think Rockstar could have some fun. I'm saying there's an opportunity here. They built a world that I think people want to continue to play in with all of these characters here. The villains are fun. And then we have some supporting heroes too. The cowardly Asian guy, Johnny Yu, comes back. Suddenly he can fight. Not sure why, but
it's because he's with Ernie Reyes Jr., one of my favorite movie stuntmen, martial artists. I talked about him at length in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because he was one of the turtles and then he was the turtle's friend. And here he is in his first movie role because his father, Ernie Reyes, was a stuntman and a martial artist. And so when they wanted a bring in a bunch of students and they thought having a kid would be fun, Ernie Reyes Jr. came in and kicked some serious ass.
Yeah, I feel like he was in a lot of stuff. Being, you know, precocious little kid. And yeah, I remember him delivering pizzas in Turtles 2, I think it was. You know, he offers something here. And yeah, it's just fun. You know, again, identifiable characters. If you're a young kid, you like to see young kids take down outrageous bad guys. And I think he needs some guy in the balls or something. But he takes one of the villains down. But the big fight, of course, everything's building down to the showdown between Shownuff and a, as of yet, unglowing Leroy.
And that was an oh shit moment for me at 10, when they're fighting, and all of a sudden, Shownuff's hands glow red. I'm like, oh my god, Bruce Leroy's dead.
Yeah, I mean, and kudos to the filmmakers here from taking us out of this chaotic, bright neon dance floor backdrop where there's a ton of fights going on, to our more intimate boss fight, if you will, has now moved into a dirty, gritty warehouse where it's going to be more about paying attention to, well, I want to say the skills that we're going to see on screen, but there's some, you know, hokey animation to create the glow here.
Hey, rotoscoping. This is where I'm like in the theater going, I'm watching Kung Fu Star Wars, because you got the red glow against the yellow glow. Keep in mind, I know Luke had a blue and green saber, but his toy that I was still playing with at that age had a yellow saber. So yellow versus red and the flashes. Yeah, this was total Star Wars.
And the fight ends up building around this water tank. And I'm thinking, in my younger days anyway, when I was half watching this, The Last Dragon was probably that monster that Arcadian keeps as a pet in the water tank. I think that that's what's going to come bursting forth like Jaws here to save him, to eat Shownuff, you know, maybe. But we never find out what that sea creature was.
I just take it as piranha. It was a tank full of piranha, the way it ate the meat off the bone.
I think they were building that up to be something a little more mythical than that. Like, looking at it, it almost looked like it had feathers, and like it was one thing with a long tail. I don't think they had the budget to create what they wanted to have in there, but I think it was more than just a piranha.
Yeah, I thought it was one creature of some supernatural significance. But be that as it may, it's just sort of a flourish, a Bond villain kind of thing to have, but not used. Not used here in the climax. I guess, you know, it's got to be Leroy winning the day. You can't have some creature come in and save him.
Yeah, that's not the movie. We get a really good martial arts fight here, though. I think that the stunt double for Shownuff and Timok get some good moves in. And we also got a couple of sub-boss battles with real martial artists over in that chaotic fight. So I'm having fun with these battles. But yes, he's going to get waterboarded, and Shownuff could kill him at any time, but he wants that submission, like Justin said. He's going to waterboard him and pull him up. Who is the master? And waterboard him again. And then we get the flashbacks in the water and Vanity's line, which was in the trailer. And it is kind of hot the way she delivers, "You look like a master to me."
Yeah, she's very beautiful in this movie. I get her. She looks both ridiculous and irresistible. And that's kind of what Last Dragon is. And yes, he breaks free and does everything that we're hoping the glow would do for you, catching bullets in his teeth and, yeah, beating down the big guy. It's quite fun. I'm not sure it's the Force, but I can't imagine a lot of kids emulating this.
I like when he goes, "Who is the master?" And Bruce Leroy has his confidence, and Timok gives that smile that's a different smile than before, and he's like, "I am." That was just badass to me. Yeah, I don't remember seeing this movie and wanting to emulate it, but I could see why I would.
Definitely.
And he does this cool spinning arm trick that the producers just admit is completely stolen from Bruce Lee in The Chinese Connection, where Bruce Lee moved his arm so fast that they had to make the film slow-mo so people could see it.
Sure. I mean, that's become a trope in martial arts now, right? I mean, the fists of fury, if you will. Now, catching the bullet in the teeth, is that a trope that we've seen before? I mean, I know I haven't seen this movie, but I've seen that happen before. Was there like a super cop movie or something around the same time?
There was. Yes, there was. I want to say it was called Super Fuzz.
Okay, that might be where I'm remembering it from too, but that must have been a thing that played out quite a bit at this time. Catching a bullet in your teeth was something I think I also saw on Real People at one point.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I'm wikiing this, and the first documents of somebody catching a bullet in their teeth is in the 1500s, but if you go to the 1900s...
A lot of failed attempts.
Yeah, nobody was good at it for 300 more years.
There was a German magician who did the bullet catch trick in the 1950s, and he'd have him bullets go through glass panes before he caught it in his teeth. He was seriously wounded 9 times but survived, but then fell off a cliff in 1975, supposedly because of constant dizziness caused by all the bullet injuries.
Mm. Oh.
So if you're thinking about that, then that was in the time, and there was Dorothy Dietrich doing bullet in the teeth tricks in 80 is what's said here. So
yeah, I would imagine with magicians it's an illusion here, but is it an action movie thing? I don't remember Bruce Lee ever doing it, but it's something I suppose someone of his caliber could do. It's a little silly, but
an illusion? Tell that to the German who got shot 9 times.
Well, it adds to the myth of what the glow is. I mean, up to this point the glow might just be the power to kick somebody's ass, but now it's kind of showing that it gives him somewhat superhuman powers.
Mm. Yeah, it allows him to find his way to the bathroom in the night.
Very helpful, actually.
So then, yeah, he had to catch the bullet because Eddie actually fired a gun. This is when Eddie goes from just Lex Luthor-esque villain to actually homicidal, and we think Leroy's down. I mean, he whips his head around, he falls over, he's playing possum so he can just wrap Eddie up in chains, and then, yeah, if this is supposed to be a superhero movie, he disappears, just like Superman would or Batman before the cops arrive.
Right, and Clark Kent seems rather virginal. It makes sense that they would end with, you know, Vanity's got to do something for this guy. I mean, he's seemingly can do anything to protect her, but she has some moves that she can teach him that he was in need of losing the glow of virginity, I suppose. So that's the note that they're going to end on here.
Yeah, I thought she'd give him an afterglow. But
I'm not sure it needed to be set to First Time on a Ferris Wheel by Smokey Robinson and Syreeta. That one was maybe my least favorite song on the soundtrack.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. That is not my favorite.
Skipping the love theme. But other than that, yeah, I mean, it's all smiles as they ascend up into seventh heaven.
So Justin Stewart, do you recommend The Last Dragon? Justin.
You know, as I said earlier, I'm really surprised this wasn't on my radar or something I saw back in the day, because it has all the elements that a fifth grade Justin would want. It's got breakdancing, it's got kung fu, it's got a pretty darn good soundtrack, and it's got comedy. You know, it just, like I said, a few years later, I'd fall in love with an even sillier movie called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, who took a lot of this stuff and just dialed it up to 10. And that movie, to me, was something I'd watch over and over and over again. And yeah, it just shocks me that I hadn't seen this before. So coming into this fresh, I wasn't sure what to expect. So I'm not really getting any of the nostalgic feel off of seeing this as a kid, but I'm enjoying it. There were a few problems that we spoke about that, you know, maybe the length could have been cut down a little bit here or there, but all in all, I enjoyed this movie and I'm happy to give it a recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, it's way more fun than I remembered. When I would have seen this, I would have been too cool for school, and everything about it, from breakdancing to parachute pants, all of that would have been passe. It would have been the late 80s, and you know, you just, oh, I can't be bothered. But now coming back to it in middle age and remembering the 80s and the nostalgia, you were right, Arnie. I want to put on the parachute pants, the leather fingerless gloves, the hat, and just go to town. This movie makes you want to live it at a time that when I was living it, I didn't want to do. So there's an irony. I want to be a part of the 80s now for having watched The Last Dragon than when I was there. And so, yeah, it's a really fun time. I put it up there with Disco Godfather. You're going to really enjoy it.
And I don't think you could ever live it, because to me, this is a fantasy of the 80s. For me, this is the movie Xanadu tried to be. I really didn't like Xanadu with its roller skate 80s musical thing, but here, this is the 80s I liked. And it also followed a trope that I really do enjoy, which is the martial arts film, the Bruce Lee films. I didn't watch a lot of them as a kid. I've kind of caught up a bit more as an adult, but it's just really simplistic storytelling that kids and adults can both enjoy. I do think, whether intentional or not, they created the Star Wars of blaxploitation kung fu films. All right, that's very specific.
Yeah, I mean, wow. That in a quarter might get you coke in 1985.
But for me, at that age, I was as enthralled walking out of the theater from this as I was walking out of Return of the Jedi. I remember walking home and my mother being like, why are you like spastic and everything? And I had had such a great time with a new group of friends who would never ask me to hang out again. Maybe because of the parachute pants.
They were also why you were asking why you were so spastic.
And I was just so into this movie. And coming back, it wasn't just the magic of a night out with friends. This movie holds up. Do I recommend this? Show enough.
Do you recommend a remake of this? Believe it or not, it has been shopped around for several years now. I believe Sam Jackson has attached his name to Shownuff when they remake, and I do say when and not if, The Last Dragon. We could be back again talking about this movie in a year or two.
I think that's heavily going to depend on the direction of the music choice and how of the now they try to make it.
Yeah, I mean, who would you get? Would you try to get a martial arts star, or would you try to get Drake or somebody from the hip-hop world?
I'm thinking, yeah, you get a rapper in there, and it's going to be modern music. I think if you do it right, it's a movie I won't enjoy. Yeah. But the movie wouldn't be made for me.
Right, exactly, exactly. We want our 80s nostalgia. This would be nostalgia for things I don't want to consume now.
And could the movie find its audience today, or would it have to wait? Like, this movie was a success in 1985. We're enjoying it now as a retro nostalgia fest, but at the time, as I'm saying, when I was in theaters watching this, I liked it without knowing it was a joke and without being able to be nostalgic for what was on MTV every day. So could you make that film that appeals to the youth of today? And if they could do like this movie does, where you appeal to all generations and all races, that would be even better. I don't know if you could do that with hardcore hip hop, though. I feel like music is simply more segregated today than it was in the 80s, when all you had were top 40 and Billboard charts were tracked very differently than they started in the 90s with SoundScan. I just don't think that you could find a musical genre that would appeal to the masses as much as Top 40 did back then.
Yeah, and add to that that martial arts and kung fu is not as nearly as novel as it was in 1985. We were seeing a lot of this stuff for the very first time back then as a country. And to bring that back now would just kind of feel rote at this point. You know what I mean? We've already had reboots of The Karate Kid, for God's sake, that didn't work out. So I'm not sure what the draw would be here for a remake.
I would think if they do it, though, and here's my fear, and it would be the wrong way to go. I think if you do it right, you make it to with today's music and appeal to the kids. I have a bad feeling that they'd make it a parody period piece and set it in the 80s and try to do it again. And then they'd be lampooning intentionally and it would end up being like Scary Movie or Disaster Movie or something like that. Only it would be 80s movie.
Brady Bunch the movie. Yeah, I mean, sometimes when they remake something as a joke, yeah, it loses an extra layer of appeal. Sometimes that just feels too clever. And yeah, I don't think it can be done. It's the bottom line. I think the only reason it will be done is because Sam Jackson likes to do movies in which he can wear outlandish clothes, and this would give him his best wardrobe ever. But I'm going to say no, you're right. I'm going to say there's a reason why it hasn't come to the screen already. Sam Jackson isn't getting any younger. Yeah, they can't figure it out because maybe it can't be done.
Yeah, I hope they don't do it, but I hope movies like it continue to exist.
Sure, yeah, exactly. Maybe a Step Up movie is the closest thing we're ever going to get.
Jacob champions them.
Yes, he does. And Jacob will be back with us next month for our next patron show. We know what it's going to be. We're going to France for a slasher film.
Another listener-chosen film, High Tension.
Don't you mean Haute Tension?
No, because I can't do a French accent poorly.
Well, I can.
Yes, that is next month's selection. I do want to again thank Kyle for his choice of The Last Dragon. Congrats. I think this is the first listener-chosen film to get three recommends.
Indeed.
Wow.
So you hit my sweet spot, and I'm so glad to have had the chance to relive this movie and get it into our schedule this way. Will we feel the same way about High Tension? Patrons, you can find that out next month. That movie is available for rent on iTunes and your usual spots. So Justin, Stewart, thank you for joining me. Patrons, thank you so much for your support. And especially Kyle, who did such a generous donation and picked this movie. But now, it's time for us to glow.
It's a celebration. You have touched the final lever. You knew without knowing. We have finished our journey together. The final lever is a return to the beginning. This is the last dragon. A cycle is complete. And now, there is a new emptiness to be filled. A new journey, which you must make alone.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Now, if you're unhappy about this, why don't you just walk out? Go have a nice, normal, boring life.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
I just don't know how to thank you.
And a special thank you to Kyle for his support of the show and choosing this movie for our review.
I am deeply in your debt. It is very valuable to me.
I know what it's like to lose precious things. And then, of course, to find them again.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Don't you go someplace and meditate on that.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forum is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
Why don't anybody who wants me to sit down and shut up come down here and make me?
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Ingonza Media Incorporated.
You want wisdom? You buy a fortune cookie.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
I am confused. Confusion is a part of life. It's a celebration.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2018, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I applaud you, Leroy. That's a great finish. Not the ending I had in mind, but it's a great finish.
Today, we're discussing Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon, starring Timok.
It can't takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
He is not a Klingon. The level that gives him a power called the glow. All of a sudden, I got the Soul Glow song from Coming to America in my hand.
Soul Glow.
This was not El DeBarge. This was actually the full DeBarge out of this. This song did go platinum, and
the full DeBarge might be one of the funniest things I've heard in a long time.
And until next time, the line.
I have a sublime glow all over my body. That was like one of the opening lines I had to write down.
Yeah.
Is it really? Oh, yeah, you had the extra luxury of really not knowing anything you were about to see.
I was a little scared at first because like, he's like green screened, like slow motion karate moves in front of. I'm like, what is happening?
But now it's time for us to glow.
Sure, that works.
When in doubt, do a pun.
Yeah.
Show enough.